Hey, cashiers. We Have the Receipts podcast is coming at you live from Netflix is a Joke Fest in Los Angeles.
Chris, are you kidding?
No, Netflix is a joke, Courtney, but this is not one of them. Our listeners in LA have the chance to join us for a live recording of our podcast, We Have the Receipts, hosted by me, Chris Burns.
And me, Courtney Revolution.
Join us and a few surprise guests from your favorite Netflix reality shows on Saturday, May 4th at 1 p.m. at a secret location in Hollywood.
To be announced.
Get your tickets for the We Have the Receipts live show at tudum.com/WHTR. That's Tudum, TUDUM.com/WHTR.
Tickets are limited. If you can't make it to the show, we still want to hear your beautiful voice. Leave us a message at speakpipe.com/WeHaveTheReceipts.
You may even hear your own voice on the show.
Grab a ticket at tudum.com/WHTR.
And we'll see you on May 4th in Los Angeles. Bye, cashiers.
I'm Rebecca Lavoy, and this is You Can't Make This Up. You Can't Make This Up is the podcast where we uncover the true stories behind your favorite Netflix documentaries and films. On today's episode, we take a closer look at the Netflix series, Files of the Unexplained.
He said, son, I've been scared in my lifetime, but I've never had anything scare me like this before.
Today, we're talking to executive producers Sky Borgman and Avril Z. Speaks. From eerie encounters to bizarre disappearances, mysterious hauntings to chilling cold cases, some mysteries are best when left unsolved. But that doesn't mean the unexplained should go unexamined. Told by witnesses of the supernatural and the extraterrestrial, the Netflix series Files of the Unexplained explores a mix of perplexing phenomena. The show also features scientists and historians who offer more earthly possibilities for these baffling puzzles. But it's left to the viewer to decide whether there are objective explanations for these riddles or whether something else is at play.
Out of the corner of my eye, someone is there. Sometimes it's a fragrance. Sometimes it's just the feel. Or that rocker rocked. Did you see that? Yeah, I saw it. Explain it, I can't.
And I'm joined now by executive producers Sky Borgman and Avril Z. Speaks. Welcome to You Can't Make This Up.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you.
So, Sky, you've directed some of my all-time favorite true crime documentaries, like Abducted in Plain Sight and The Girl in the Picture, but you've also been producing stories of the strange and unnatural. You've done a couple of episodes of Netflix's Unsolved Mysteries. What is it about this genre that appeals to you?
I think this genre is just so open, especially any stories of the unexplained. And in this series, particularly, everything is on the table. It could be UAPs. It could be haunted houses. It could be sea creatures. It could be unexplained mysteries of people's disappearances. And so that unexplained quality and the openness of these stories and the ability to tell so many stories is really appealing.
So is there some whodunit crossover for you, Sky? Because when you're putting together a true crime series, you don't always know the answer either, right? I mean, it's just kind of the same muscle a little bit.
A little bit, although with this one, I mean, it could be, right? Like some of our episodes could have a lot of whodunit, others not so much. And I think another important thing with this is that we also look sort of beyond just what the unexplained event is into some possible scenarios of how it could have happened and some deeper historical sort of elements and some elements of crime that happened decades or centuries ago. And so there is sort of a whodunit, but ultimately I think part of the appeal of this episode or of this series really is that these truly are unexplainable events.
Yeah. So, Avril, Netflix viewers love Unsolved Mysteries. Can you talk about Files of the Unexplained? You know, how is this different? How is this a different kind of series than what we're used to seeing?
I like to call Files of the Unexplained like a mixed bag of mysteries. It's so many different types of stories. Like Sky mentioned, you know, we have alien abductions. There's haunted houses. There's cold cases. There's kind of a mixed bag. But I think the other thing that makes this series unique is that we kind of go into it through, we tried to go in through it with an investigative, kind of like as an investigative journalist. and also to take firsthand accounts. So every episode starts with a firsthand account of someone who has experienced something. And then we kind of go on the journey for the next 30 minutes. And then we talk about, did this happen or did this not happen, through what we call a ledger of possibilities. So we're kind of looking at what is possible and what actually happened through those ledgers. And so it's a fun journey through what happened in that original person's story.
Avril, I have to ask, are you an X-Files fan? Because I'm getting some Mulder and Scully vibes here when you're talking about actually investigating these mysteries.
There's some of that, but there's also just that journalism, background. I think my journalism background kicks in as well, of just wanting to get to the bottom, but also not take a side, And I think that's one of the things that we really tried to do in the series, is not say yes or no, but to leave it to the audience and let the audience play armchair detective.
Right, right. So there are 8 episodes of Files of the Unexplained, and Avril described them as a mixed bag because you do have this mix of stories about the supernatural, extraterrestrials, and cold cases. When plotting out the season, Sky, I'm wondering, like, how many stories did you kick the tires on? How did you come down to these 8?
I mean, there were hundreds, honestly. Like, when Avril and I first started researching out what possible stories could be, and we had a spreadsheet of hundreds of stories. And then we really started deciphering them down, kind of going, okay, which ones can we get a first person perspective on? Which ones have enough archive or have enough voices to tell this story that are sort of modern day enough-ish? Or if they're not modern day enough-ish, how do we tell this story? So really it came down to, where can we get a first person perspective? And do we have the voices to tell this story? And is it something that both of us were like, if we had questions, if we were left with truly thinking this was unexplained, it was a story that kind of made it into our top tier.
Yeah, yeah. So, Avril, one of the things that sets Files of the Unexplained apart are these visual elements. There's a really distinctive style of animation that you employ throughout. And I'm wondering, what were the marching orders for the art department? What was that supposed to evoke for the viewer?
We wanted to do a sort of collage animation where, we were kind of layering different images. And also, again, we're taking audiences on a journey, and we're taking them on a journey to think through, did this happen or did this not happen? And so part of the marching orders were that we wanted to create a world. We wanted to create, we wanted to build the visuals around each one of these events. And part of the way to do that was to sort of do this collage animation where we were kind of layering different elements of the story, also to keep certain things front of mind for the audience. So we wanted to try to layer them that way to always keep things at the forefront, bring people back. Like, remember, we talked about this, and kind of as a visual way of doing that.
So for some people, Avril, though, there are no other possibilities. Some people are all in on the strange and unexplained. They want to hear it's a ghost or it's an alien. And you said you're coming at this from a journalism background. So I'm wondering, in your editorial conversations, how are you striking that balance, trying not to alienate the people who just are the opposite of skeptical and also bring people in like me who also want to hear maybe a more practical explanation, but who also likes to entertain, the fantastical, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think it all comes down to those stories. I think those personal stories were really key. I think we approached each one of these episodes as we're taking these stories at face value. They say they were abducted. We're believing that they were abducted, but then kind of counterbalancing that with experts. Like, we had experts that we interviewed who, were able to kind of posit what another alternative could be. And that was kind of one of the criteria for each of the stories that we chose, was making sure that there was a different point of view that would say otherwise. So that way we kind of keep a balance between those believers and unbelievers and kind of have something for everyone.
Yeah. So it feels less, Sky, like you're bringing in naysayers to directly refute the stories. It feels more like, almost like an equal time, like multiple possibilities kind of vibe. I don't know. I mean, did you feel like you wanted to satisfy like a variety of different kinds of minds when you were making this? I'd love to hear that from you.
Definitely. I mean, I think we are both open. Avril and I are both open to the possibilities. We surrounded ourselves, our crew from production, sort of prepping, production and post-production, had a variety of different levels of believers on any certain scenario, right? And so we surrounded ourselves with some skeptics. We were certainly in the field with skeptics. We were in post with some people who were true believers who have experienced certain things in their lives. And so it was really great to be surrounded by people. And I think for Avril and I both, we were really interested in sort of going that middle line, because I think everybody's out there. And look, the episodes all sort of run the gambit, right? From how did these people disappear to were they abducted from aliens, or is there haunted houses? And so some people are going to believe some things, other people are going to believe other things. And so really sort of striking that balance was important.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the cases in the files, and I'm going to bounce around a little bit. Avril, I want to start with you and talk about the Myrtle's Plantation case. And we have to start, I don't know, first of all, I don't know if this is a place I would go at all, not only because of the ghost, but because of all the dolls. I mean, are you like me when you see dolls, or are you just like, nope, 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 nope? I mean, and then she's like, and then the doll will sometimes look the other way. I'm like, no, 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 no. I mean, there is something about dolls, right, that evokes something that we should not be looking at as grown people. I mean, in my mind.
No, you're totally right. The dolls are bizarre. The dolls are very creepy. And they had, Myrtle's actually has an entire room that's just dolls. And, you know, when you walk in, it's just like dolls on a mantle. And, you know, there's this whole rumor that, you know, you can look at a doll and it's looking one way, and then you turn away and look, and then it's looking a different direction. And there's so many stories like that. And it's like when you're there for a period of time, then you start, you're like, something does look a little strange about that one right there. So creepy.
Well, just so you know, if anyone out there is actually like enjoys this kind of experience, you can actually buy, quote, haunted dolls on Etsy. I've seen them there. They're not cheap, but they come with their own stories. And apparently they're always looking for new homes. So anyway, I digress. This plantation is allegedly haunted by an enslaved girl named Chloe, who poisoned the family. And you bring in some experts to show how historical facts don't line up with folklore. You know, Chloe may never have existed. And they bring up this really interesting point about the projection of racism on this ghost tale and on other ghost tales. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this was an interesting story that, you know, we kind of wanted to talk about sort of this underlying, you know, phenomenon, if you will, of plantations and plantation tourism and kind of the historical background of that. And so this story in particular was really interesting because there you have the story of Chloe, but there's questions about whether or not she actually existed. And so, and then it kind of plays into the whole haunted element of it. Like, is it haunted? Like, is it really haunted? Like, was there really a girl there? In the case of Myrtle's, there's so many haunting stories at Myrtle's. And so it's like, whether that happened or not, you know, there's still other, there's, and I mean, I want to say that there was maybe like 50 murders or something that have happened on the Myrtle's plantation. And so it's a question of, you know, does that challenge the credibility of it being haunted? And I don't think it does. I think that, you know, there's so much going on. There's so much history behind, you know, in that plantation overall, that it's something worth looking at.
And this story sort of stuck around, that there was a ghost who haunted the house. She seemed to be the resident spirit here, a woman in a green turban. Well, when the story of Chloe was created out of thin air, it was using the story of the ghost with the green turban, even though the descriptions didn't match. But we don't want to let facts get in the way of a good story. At least that's what happened.
You know, even though Chloe may not have existed, there probably were, you know, just given the time period and also giving the area of town where that occurred, there probably was slavery going on there. There were probably some horrors happening there. And so that doesn't negate that at all, even though this one particular person by this particular name may not have existed. So that's something that we tried to get across.
I will say, as another aside, Sky, I've watched a lot of ghost stories that feature a lot of ghost hunters. It's one of my kids' favorite genres, even though they're adults now. And I've never heard any of these people say he let one of the ghosts play with his toes.
That part.
In this room, the John Leake room, I had my foot sticking out of the bed and somebody grabbed my ankle and started playing with my toes.
Were you surprised by this very enthusiastic ghost hunting guy who was just, you know, all in on this experience?
I mean, I'll tell you, there's very little that surprises me now. That may have been one of the things, but look, I think it's one of the things that also makes our series really special is that people are all in and that there is this sense of belief that they all bring to their stories. And so listening to something like that, you kind of go, man, I would never let somebody, a ghost, tickle my toes or play with my toes. But then I've never been in that scenario before. So maybe I would. Yeah. Who knows?
Or go back. He was a guy that was like, oh, yeah, we went back. Like 100, every year we go back.
And I know.
Those tickle my toes.
And his wife, his poor wife, who's like, you know, can we go on? I mean, I would imagine I would be like, can we go on a different place to hang out? Maybe not
exactly.
A ghosty place. You know, Vegas, exactly. Maybe. I don't know. Anyway.
There's other options.
It's true. So some of the themes in the Myrtle's Plantation episode get repeated or shadowed in the episode about Mount Shasta. There are a mix of religious beliefs and legends around the mountain, but it seems like modern New Age spirituality very often co-opts or erases Black lore, Indigenous lore. Sky, is this something that you know, felt was important to really bring to the story?
I definitely did. I mean, I think that, you know, when we look at sort of some of the New Age ideas, concepts, you know, we feel like it's kind of a positive thing, but but there's a lot of times where we're not really looking at what they've been sort of abstracted from. And so looking at Mount Shasta in particular and how the Indigenous people sort of survived there and these ideas that have been this place that has really allowed for all of these wonderful things to come out of it, all these different ways of thinking, all of these different spiritualities, all of these different sort of natural experiences, but how those and this utter sort of pool of acceptance can also, I don't know, breed these sort of ways of, I guess, abstracting where it really comes from. And so that was, for Shasta especially, I think that was one of the storylines that was really, really compelling to me.
Sky, I'm curious, when those people were talking about getting to Telos, mm-hmm. are they talking about a state of mind or were they talking about something metaphysical?
It was always a little bit different.
I take people through meditation into the inner earth city of Telos. One woman, I took her into Telos. After several minutes, she starts sobbing with tears coming down her face. And she goes, I have never, ever felt that kind of love. And I've been looking for it all my life.
It depends on who you talk to. I mean, some people, it was a metaphysical location, but also this metaphysical place sort of actually existed for people. So it's different depending on each person's sort of spirituality or their level of belief or their level of vibrations, as they would probably say. I mean, there are some people who go there who look for actual entrances into Telos that are doorways in the side of a mountain or doorways into a cave, and so that they feel like they can get there. And whether or not it's a metaphysical entrance or an actual entrance, it changes depending on people's experiences. Hmm.
So the whole series opens up with a classic story about alien abduction. It takes place in Pascagoula, Mississippi in 1973. And we've now had so many stories about UFO lore, abductions, and we see how they're generally treated by sort of mainstream media types. And Avril, were you at all surprised by the solemnity with which the TV journalist talked about this abduction report? I found myself being like a little taken aback and surprised by that, honestly.
I think what's interesting about Pascagoula, it's such a personal story. It's such a personal journey. These two men, they were just regular guys, you know, fishermen, you know, fishing on the river. And I think that the way everyone reacted to it was kind of like a sign of the times there. But I think it was also a reaction to these two men. I mean, these were in many ways unsuspecting people. I mean, even just to get to know Eddie and Calvin, Eddie Hickson, whose father was the one who was abducted, his father, Charles Hickson, and Calvin Parker. They're just very unassuming people, you know, just living life in Pascagoula. And so the fact that this happened in this small town was kind of like a really shocking event that happened.
UFOs are here now.
A number of scientists take them very seriously.
The sheriff's department was getting something like 2,000 or 3,000 phone calls during that week. Those were mostly people afraid or worried or curious.
And so I think that the way it was reported kind of reflects, you know, that small town vibe that like, wow, we can't believe something like this happened in our town. So it's a really interesting story that just has a lot of heart. Like I look at that story, and in doing that story, you just really feel for these people who had something really extraordinary happen in their lives that they'll never forget. And that also traumatized them for many years as well.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because they, as you said, they did live these humble lives, Charles and Calvin. But then this encounter made them kind of extraordinary people for a period of time. And then they had to go back to their humble lives, and it affected each one of them very differently. Is that a cautionary tale? I mean, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, in some ways it is. You know, like you said, both Charlie and Calvin handled the experience very differently. Charlie did radio interviews, TV interviews. He kind of became a local celebrity, if you will. And Calvin did the exact opposite. He went into hiding and didn't talk to anyone. He was traumatized by what happened. You know, he kind of went through his own, you know, he had his own way of dealing with it. And it wasn't until a few years ago that he came forward and started telling his story.
Really, I didn't do her right because I waited a long time to talk to her about it. 18 years. No, more than that.
More than 18, darling.
Yeah. How do you tell somebody that you love something like that where they think you're an idiot or something?
It's really interesting to kind of look at, even as you look at the event itself, just to kind of take into account not just how they handled it, but also what that says about kind of where we are in time. I think there's something about the time period, you know, to your prior question, I think there's something about this time period where Calvin even felt comfortable to be able to come out and start speaking out because he started seeing more people being more accepting and more people are talking about UAPs, and that's a more of a topic of conversation. And he felt more comfortable to talk about it.
Yeah. I'm curious, Sky, because trauma plays a role here, too. And, you know, we recently did another series on this podcast about UFOs and alleged alien abductions. And the director of that series told me that, like, he couldn't speak to whether or not the experiences were real, but he could absolutely speak to the fact that the trauma was real. That's something that all these people shared. I mean, there is something there, right? Like, you can't deny somebody's trauma, even if you have questions about what their actual experience was.
Absolutely. I mean, that couldn't be more true. And regardless of what their actual experience is, whether it's alien abductions, whether it's a haunting that is something that people have a traumatic reaction to, whether it's the sighting of something, whether it's the loss of a person in their life, then they don't know what happened to them. This trauma is something that will be real and will affect not just the people who are closest to them, but the ripple effects of people, their children. I mean, and that's especially true in the Pascagoula episode, where you see how this trauma affects the children of these two guys. And so trauma is something that no matter what is an absolute truth.
I'm curious about the microchip incident. There was a microchip found in his knee and then it disappeared. I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, is that something that sparked your curiosity?
In that episode where we're really talking about this microchip and this alien implantation and whether or not this is something that could have actually happened. Look, again, it's his reality. Did it happen? Did aliens come back? Did they take the microchip out? Or is it even a microchip? I mean, who knows what that little thing is, you know? So really, it is his experience. And further to that, it's the silencing. And we're talking about trauma. And this man felt absolutely silenced by doctors, by the military, by everybody who he told his story to. And so I think that's really what we're talking about is the trauma that he experienced from being silenced.
Right, right. So there's a connection between that episode, in my mind, and the episode about the Yuba County Five. In 1978, five men with either developmental disabilities or mental illness disappeared after their car was discovered on the side of the Snowy Mountain. Several months later, we learned the fate of four of the five men. In this episode, there is a lot of focus on the families of the victims in this case, more so than the mystery of the woods. And I'm curious, Avril, was that the point here to tell this much more intimate story and talk about who these men were?
Yeah, I think when with Yuba County Five, when we started researching that project, it kind of started with the families. And it was really important for us to highlight their stories and to highlight, again, it goes back to those personal experiences. And so what was their experience going through that? But then also the aftermath, you know, you talked about the trauma, you know, it's the aftermath of what that did for them to have no answers about what happened to their loved ones.
Foul play suspected in disappearance of five slightly retarded Californians.
And do you think that that's the...
Why would you say retarded?
It's what they said back...
That's like... That's just not right. A little bit slower than... If they would have said five championship basketball players for Gateway got lost, they would have probably found them. Instead of saying this shit, I think it would have went a lot different. They would have looked harder.
We really wanted that personal connection. And with Yuba in particular, it really started there anyway. You know, that's kind of where those stories started, was having those conversations with the families. And I don't think that they've ever really gotten closure on those stories. And so, you know, we tried very much with this series to give them a platform just to be able to speak out and to talk about it.
Skye, has it been your experience that when you talk to folks, you know, I don't want to speak to these Yuba County Five families' experiences, but do they often have experiences where they've told their story and haven't had good experiences with the media or with the way that that story has been portrayed? And is that something you take in consideration?
Definitely. I think they've had those experiences. But honestly, with Yuba County Five, my experience more was that they hadn't had the opportunity to tell their story. People hadn't come to talk to family members. And that was something that angered a lot of them, is that nobody, you know, they really told these stories about the missing men and nobody came to really talk to them and ask them what their perspective was with family members. And so, again, people felt unheard, they felt unasked, and they felt unlistened to. And so they really appreciated having the opportunity to tell their story. Sure, it's happened with stories, and it's always something I think we take into consideration. Is telling your story something that could be re-traumatizing? I think it can be. I think it can also be something that's very therapeutic and very cathartic for people. And being able to have their side of the story told is a powerful thing.
Well, I want to make a bit of a turn. I do have a production question about one of your episodes. You take us to the Pacific Northwest for a story about these bizarre blobs that fell from the sky after a rainstorm. And I have to ask, Avril, what were those blobs? How did you make them? What was the practical nature of the making of that episode like?
Oh, my. That was a process. That was such a process. Because in production, we had some kind of jelly. I can't remember what it's called, but there was some kind of jelly that we used. And we, you know, so we're sitting there like rubbing our hands together with trying to make this. And then we also did some experiments with dish soap and gelatinous beads that we found from Michael's. And I think Skye actually made some kind of paste out of slime.
Slime.
Nice.
It was actually
like a third grader.
I Googled the recipe.
It was a fun day. to say the least.
I love the image of you going into Michael's and just loading up your cart with stuff. You know, you're standing in the line behind, you know, somebody who has, you know, all the dried flowers and their crafting supplies, and you've got all these beads so that you can recreate
totally.
A mysterious event.
Ironically, what worked really great, we had, I think there were like these salt. It was like some kind of rock salt. And we would pour hand sanitizer on them and they would pop. And so we would be filming and they'd be like, it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah. So I'm curious, because there's not a lot of empirical science used, you know, for hauntings and close encounters, even though we do see some of these ghost hunters with what they describe to be very, you know, delicate machinery. But here in this story, there is a physical thing that scientists put under literal microscopes. And it seems like, Skye, of all of these cases, this could have been one that we should have been able to find like a real answer for, right?
I agree. I mean, I think the ball was dropped in such a massive way, and these potential facts that could have been found were hidden and were never sort of brought to light.
My dad did say suits came in, and I was like, suits? And he was like, yeah, he didn't know if it was government, but he said black suits. That's what the lady at the front desk told him, that black suits came and took it.
That's another part of this series, really, as a whole, is there are ways to find answers to certain things. It's just that a lot of these answers are being held back.
Well, let's make another switch to a different story. You interviewed Canadian author Michael Slade. His book, Death's Door, told a story about body parts washing ashore. And then soon after, feet still in their sneakers began washing ashore. I have to say, did it occur to you in the moment to say, Michael, where were you on the day of dot, dot, dot? Probably not, right?
I never did ask him that question, I don't think, but...
So we can understand some of the science of why the bones of the feet would separate from submerged corpses. But what's fascinating is that they're washing ashore now because of the buoyancy of modern sneakers. And I'm curious, Avril, does this mean that there have been feet floating around or in the ocean for years before this that just haven't come ashore?
I mean, possibly. I mean, part of what's so interesting about severed feet and about this particular story is that they're showing up in this particular part, in this particular area. So it's all very peculiar either way.
Skye, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about this story, because this has actually been a mystery that's been in the news, you know, over the last few years, and I've been paying attention to it, and it does seem... It's weird. I mean,
it's
right?
Weird.
Yeah,
it's definitely weird. I mean, and that's the thing is, like, I think there are explanations. You can look at the currents, you can look at the tides, and you can see, okay, how these feet may have washed up on these particular shores in Canada and the Pacific Northwest of the United States. You can explain away a lot of things with the buoyancy of sneakers, how feet aren't staying at the bottom of the oceans anymore. They're sort of rising to the top. What you can't explain is how there are 21 feet within a matter of time that have washed ashore in this one particular area and seemingly nowhere else on the planet, right?
In the end, what we're left with is the statistical improbability of 21 feet being found in this limited area in a limited time. You can't just sweep it under the carpet because it's inconvenient and just pretend this is all natural. Something is going on here.
And that's just weird. And so, yeah,
yes.
Maybe there are more buoyant sneakers, but why are the more buoyant sneakers just in this part of the world, right? So there's something definitely happening here. I don't think it's a serial killer. I don't necessarily think it's a sea creature, but there is something happening here that's very bizarre.
Hmm. Well, speaking of what lurks beneath, you take us to Lake Lanier in Georgia.
As I was swimming, I saw something at my foot. Thought it was a fish, because you know you're in a lake. And then I felt something grab around my ankle and yank me real fast. And the water completely went over my head.
This is a man-made lake with a statistically high number of water deaths. You know, there's the poltergeist theory, the idea that the lake is cursed because it was constructed over indigenous burial lands and an historically black community. There's also, I think, a very cogent argument that Lanier is a party lake and that many of these are fatal accidents that have to do with alcohol and reckless boating and sort of lack of understanding of the dangers of the water. But I found myself wondering, and I couldn't not wonder this, especially after your very personal opening of the episode, Avril, is there any chance that some combination of both of these things could possibly be true?
Absolutely. 100%. That's my theory about it. I think all of these things are happening. Even in filming, you know, when they took us out onto the lake and just explaining what was there and just how dangerous that lake is. I mean, anyone will tell you that it's a dangerous lake and you can't just get out there and just float around. It's also very deceiving. Like, I think people think, oh, it's a lake, like I can swim from here to there. There's parts of that lake that are extremely deep and very dangerous. You know, not only is it deep, but there's a bridge under Lake Lanier.
Yes. I mean, Avril, isn't, I mean, like, there's like this idea of haunting, right? But isn't this also, they're real, this lake actually kind of is literally haunted by the community that's underneath it, right?
Yeah.
The stuff that's there is killing people. That is a haunting of its own in a way, right?
Totally, totally. It's really interesting because you would have people that say, no, the lake is not haunted. And no, there's nothing under the lake. But let me show you this bridge. Let me show you this, you know, house that's underneath. Yeah. You know, it's like, it is very real that there's a town that's buried under there. That's factual information. I don't think anyone will dispute the fact that there was once a town that was there. People will dispute whether or not it's haunted, and you know that that's up for debate. But there's no debate that there was a town there, that there were lands there, that there, you know, still is debris, that there was a raceway under there. So there's a lot that's underneath that lake. And there are signs around that say, you know, don't swim, don't dive. And, you know, people do what they want to do and don't necessarily follow those rules. And so accidents do happen.
Since the days around the campfire, we've often come to fear things that we can't explain. And for some, that fear turns into fascination. Skye, does trying to solve the mystery, I mean, do you worry that it's sort of, it's like ruining the point of having these kinds of stories? Because isn't the mystery kind of the point sometimes?
Absolutely. The mystery is the fun of it. And I think we didn't really go into any of these episodes wanting to solve this unexplained event, but just put out our ledger of possibilities and say, it could be this, it could be this, it could be this. And we always love sort of walking away from something and letting the audience kind of percolate on, could it be this or could it be that? Or I buy this, but I don't buy that. And so that's absolutely part of the mystery. And we wanted people to feel like they were sitting around the campfire telling these spooky stories and talking about, you know, what could have happened here or what could have happened there.
Well, finally, I want to ask Averill, when you put a series like this into the world, there are so many things viewers can take away from it, especially with so many different kinds of stories and on a platform like Netflix, and it's going to reach so many people. I'm curious, what are you hoping that your audience will take away from Files of the Unexplained?
One of the things that I hope people take away is empathy for the people that went through this. So, you know, you take, you know, the families of Yuba County Five, you take Terry Lovelace, who has this microchip in his body and is going through his own form of trauma. And I hope people take away that empathy for people that have been through these experiences and are still living with those experiences. I also hope people take away just this sense of mystery. Like, you know, I think that mystery is a wonderful thing. I don't think we don't have to explain everything. Sometimes the fun is in going on the journey and looking at what the possibilities are. And I hope people are ready to go along that journey. And, you know, some things may be open-ended. I hope some people will maybe challenge their ideas. You know, there might be people who were unbelievers in UAPs, and visitations from other worlds. But maybe there's an inkling, there's a little chance that they might think, maybe there is something out there. Maybe we're not the only ones here. So hopefully there'll be some mind shifts, but also empathy for these people who had these experiences.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more. It's just a series, I think, that really opens up possibilities and allows a platform to be listened to and a platform for people to kind of tell their stories and for others to kind of hopefully come in and listen in a deeper way.
Well, executive producers Skye Borgman and Averill Z Speaks, the series is Files of the Unexplained, and it certainly shifted my mind a little bit. Thank you so much to both of you for joining me to talk about it. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. Thanks again to Skye Borgman and Averill Z Speaks. For more of my takes, check out my other podcast, Crime Writers On. Each week on that show, we break down the latest in true crime documentaries, TV shows, podcasts, and pop culture. If you like You Can't Make This Up, please rate and review this show and share it with your friends. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. And make sure to follow the show to stay tuned for all new episodes. You Can't Make This Up is a production of Netflix. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Thanks so much for listening.